Good morning, Spokane. You're listening to KYRS Thin Air Community Radio. This is Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor Weech, and I'm here live today without a guest talking about a topic that came up after last week's show, which you may know was about anarchy, the dirty A word that we don't talk about. And in conversations after that show with a few different people, the main topic that tended to come up was police, whether it's and policing in general, whether it's people self-policing in an anarchist system or how do we deal with, as a society, folks who want to be destructive to others. And how we do that is through a police force. So I thought that it'd be interesting to take a broader look at the concept of police and what our local challenges have been, and which we're all pretty familiar with, I think, at this point. There's been a lot of coverage of that, especially the Otto Zem case, which I'm going to talk about a little bit, and then a couple other specific instances with the local police, and then what people are doing, how people are organizing around that. But I also just wanted to look at the whole concept of a police state, because in one of these conversations after the show on anarchy that I just did, I was having a conversation with two individuals, and one was pretty aggressively characterizing the society we live in as a police state, and the other was adamantly against that notion and said basically that this person's completely misled, they don't understand what a police state is, and that we couldn't possibly be in one. So I kind of just want to start local, broaden out, and see, you know, try to find some evidence. Are we in one? Aren't we? How can you define it? And what's the reality of what's going on right now? And what can people do about it? Because that's kind of what this show is all about, is practical action that individuals can take. So it's a handful, but that's what we're going to do. So I think most people at this point in time are familiar to at least some extent with the Otto Zem case, which was a horrible, horrible incident that happened involving Spokane Police Department, four officers, I believe, responding to a call and reacting in not the appropriate way, using excessive force, what was later judged to be excessive force, and resulting in the death of a middle-aged disabled man named Otto Zem. So on June 14th, the Center for Justice hosted an event about this with Terry Sloyer and Brianne Beggs, who were both attorneys on the case during that time and are no longer with Center for Justice. But I'm going to replay some of this footage that on the local news played the entire event, Walking with Otto Zem, on June 25th. So you can also find that podcast on kyrs.org and check out the entire 30 minutes if you'd like to. It's really interesting, and that's where I took it from. And thanks to Don Hamilton, who recorded this footage that I'm now reusing as well. So this first part is Terry Sloyer talking about meeting with Otto Zem's mother. And then she talks also about some of the larger repercussions to the community and how actions like this really permeate an entire city, and how the echoes of something like this happening resound for a long time. And then the second voice you'll hear is Brianne Beggs, who kind of touches on the culture of the police department here and why this case took 6 years to complete, why the trial took that long. So we will cue that up right now. You'll hear Terry Sloyer followed by Brianne Beggs.
Her biggest concern was that while she wanted people held accountable, she also realized, had a real sort of intrinsic spiritual understanding of the role of police officers in the community, and she appreciated that, which was pretty profound for me to, as I'm working with her. But the thing that I feel so incredibly privileged about in this case was that I got to know Otto as a human being and who he was through his mother. And so he became very real to me. And while this is resulting in transformation and change, and that's a positive, wonderful thing, I don't think any one of us that have children would have given up our children's lives to have this transformation. And as many of you will recall, one of the last things that he said to the officers as they were tackling him was, "All I wanted was a Snickers." And he did, in fact, have a 2-liter bottle of Pepsi in his hand, as we know is a violent, violent weapon. I, I think that the other thing that I want to say about this that became so very clear to me in working in this case was the families of the people that are working at SkillSkin, for example, that have some level of disability, this experience for them was like putting ice water in their veins. That the family members of people who are disabled and have a difficult time being able to articulate with law enforcement when approached so abruptly, that this could be any one of their loved ones who is misunderstood. And I'm don't know how they'll ever quite get over that fear, to be honest with you. You know, it was those little auto buttons that you see that a lot of you are wearing, the little ones. It was his community that made the big ones, because they never wanted to forget Otto because he was such a good friend to them. But they also, their family members, did never want to forget, because they don't know if it's safe for their loved one who is functional yet disabled to walk down the street and know that they're safe. And I didn't have a clear understanding until I met with the people from SkillSkin and other families that have disabled members, just how profound the fear is for them. And I get that now.
And our number one message was, until the city states publicly that what happened in the Zip Trip was wrong, it can never change. And you can never be confident that your loved one won't meet the same fate. And the city took a position, kind of an old school, old psychology position, was you can't let them see your sweat. You can never admit that anything was wrong. And I'm not sure what the second piece of that is, but that was their truth. You can never admit it. One highly placed person told me that the police union went to the mayor's office and said, if you want union contracts, you can never settle this case. Don't know if it's true. Something like that was going on. There was a complete wall that no matter what, I mean, I had great talks with both Jim Craven and Howard Delaney, and they were like, yes, we want to work this out. We want to work this out. And yet nothing would ever happen. We made our best attempts on getting police ombudsmen in place and other things, and we were somewhat successful in doing that. But the three-year statute of limitations was coming up. We had to file suit. So we did file suit. The city answered, and they said, there is one truth in this case, and that is it is all AutoZem's fault. As a lawyer, I'm used to someone saying, well, we got a different point of view. What I really expected the defense would be was, yeah, mistakes were made, we're at fault, it wasn't intentional, but, you know, what are the damages? He's a single guy, he has no dependents. That's what I really thought was going to be the defense, but it was not the defense. The defense was it was all Otto's fault, which was not a very good legal strategy at all, is that the powers that be, whoever they were, could not imagine saying, we were wrong, we're sorry. And yet, mostly what my client wanted, Mrs. Zim, was to just say that. That's mostly what she wanted. And mostly what the community wanted in order to sleep better at night was just to hear that. People really, especially originally, did not want the pound of flesh. But as the denials continued, people did want a pound of flesh. And we ended up in a criminal prosecution that's got to have cost $1 million or more.
So that was Brianne Beggs at the June 14th event, Walking with Otto Zem, talking about some of the challenges that Center for Justice faced while attempting to prosecute Carl Thompson and the other officers involved in the incident, which resulted in Otto Zem's death. And I thought what was really interesting about that clip, both what Brianne was saying just then and what Terry Sawyer was saying before that, is it kind of demonstrates the power that police have and the power that we've given to this group of people and entrusted with keeping citizens safe. That, in my mind, is kind of the main charge of police. And yet you see these instances of police brutality and things like that. And as Terry pointed out, this entire community, which you could apply to other communities, but the entire community of disabled people and their families now has that thought in their mind. You know, could this happen to my loved one? Just because of a lack of training on the part of these people who have so much power and so much clout in the community that it seems to be that they even believe that they're in the right when something like this happens. So it really shows a fundamental disconnect between the policies that we have and the laws that we say we're upholding and what the individuals we trust to uphold them understand. And it's obviously a high pressure job to be a police officer, you know, and it's just difficult to accept that things like this happen. And I guess part of what I want to explore is, do we have to accept things like this happening? Is there a different way to do it? And later on, we're going to get to some more solutions. But a big part of the problem, I think, is just the concept of institutionalized power in general, and one group of people having power over another group. And while the police in theory are held to follow the laws that they enforce, we see time and time again that that's not true. We see people getting away with things that are found later to be inappropriate, to be misconduct, and they're either only terminated and not prosecuted criminally, or they keep their jobs and continue doing what they're doing. That's what happens the majority of the time. Sometimes there is justice, but a lot of the time this kind of exclusive power structure that exists maintains its power rather than admit that they're wrong, admit that policies are wrong. And that's just kind of part and parcel of the whole concept of having a police force that's in its own group like that. And I think one instance that you saw this in, a friend of mine on Facebook posted after the recent police shooting out north and the big chase that happened. She pointed out that she lives out north, and she said she saw at least, you know, 40 to 50 officers responding to this incident, which was serious. There was someone on a high-speed chase shooting police, hijacking cars. It was a big deal. But she made a joke that next time she needed help from the police, that she would identify herself as an officer so that she'd get such a response, which was cynical, but possibly true. So there's the whole idea of, you know, certain groups having to be afraid based on how police respond to them. And then there's the difficulty of a city, for instance, the city of Spokane, trying to negotiate with the police guild, with a powerful group like this that has its own interests in mind. So those are two of the challenges that we see on the local level. And I think they pretty neatly expand out to the broader levels, to the national scope and the international as well. You have this special group of people designated to enforce the laws. And with that comes a great deal of power. And with that, as we know, generally will come at least some corruption. So I'm also definitely willing to take your calls this morning. If you have any input on this, the number is 747-3807. And I can get you live on the air to chat about this. The other local event that I wanted to discuss and partially commemorate, because it was exactly 5 years ago today, there was a group of folks in Riverfront Park, people may remember this incident, having a protest, a peaceful protest, on police brutality and also on imperialism in general, I believe. I wasn't there. But I was in high school, and I remember there were some high school students involved and some just older that I was associated with. And I remember hearing vaguely about this incident. Basically, the protest was cracked down on, and 15 people ended up being arrested. I was looking to find video of it, and the official police video that they took is online, but it's almost impossible to see a lot of it because the camera's being obscured by both corners of their uniforms and signs and things like that. And I also wouldn't have been able to broadcast it due to the language content on both sides from both protesters and police. So what I am going to play is Will Elder, who is a former KYRS DJ, shout out to Thin Air Community Radio. And he was there and was not arrested. And he has his account of what happened on this video. There's a blog called SpokanePoliceAbuses.wordpress.com, and someone has, I'm not sure who it is, but or a group of people has compiled a lot of information that is helpful for people seeking out the history of police brutality in Spokane, or just looking for more information about how to follow investigations and things like that. So this is Will Elder on that incident that happened. I'm just kind of going to focus on this and the AutoZem event today. So this was July 4th, 2007. So exactly 5 years ago this week. We can hear what happened directly from Will. It's loaded.
Your contention is right there on your sign. And what's your name?
My name is Will Elder.
And you were at the protest on July 4th?
I was at the protest on July 4th.
And so what do you have to back up your sign there?
Well, I have my own personal experience in my eyes and my ability to interpret reality.
And what happened? What went down?
What happened was, it's kind of a longer story. There was a march on July 2nd that was dubbed the Second Annual March for Rights. The march met in Peaceful Valley underneath the Maple Street Bridge. It started off with three speakers. The three speakers were then followed up by a police officer. Gave us a warning, let us know that if we broke any traffic laws or hindered the rights of other citizens, that we would be subject to arrest, but that having said this, he could then leave us alone and the police would never follow us or escort us. They then left, we went on our march. The march was uneventful as far as those two precautions that the police gave us. We didn't break traffic violations and we didn't infringe upon anybody else's rights. The march was fairly lively and uneventful, except for the march itself, until we got to the clock tower. At the clock tower, we laid out an American flag as a picnic blanket. People sat down to have a picnic. The demonstration was called over, and we were then to eat and have discussion. While we were there eating and having discussion, there was a circle of cops that started forming. At first it was 6-8 cops, then it was 10, 12. By the time the cops had finished grouping around us in a circle, there was about 20, 25 cops. One of the police officers pulled out a camera and started taking pictures of the protesters. One of the young men who's across the street currently held up a cardboard sign to block all the pictures that were being taken. This frustrated the officer apparently. He did sort of a football move to get by this young man with the cardboard sign. By the time he was done with his football move trying to get by him, he was right on top of the protesters on their picnic blanket. He started snapping pictures of everyone he could, and on his way out of the group, he pushed the young man off of a bucket. The young man who was on a bucket fell off the bucket. When he got up, he demanded from the cop to know why he was pushed off the bucket. The cop didn't do anything but get right up in his face. He got, I would say, within a half inch of the cop's, the cop got within a half inch of his face. The young man attempted to clear his space by brushing his arm over the cop, touched the cop, and from then on it was a melee. The cops attacking and this young man trying to defend himself. The first cop attempted to bring him down to the ground, was successful in bringing him down to the ground. There were then four or five other cops who rushed in and aided in his bringing down to the ground, or aided in his submission because he was already on the ground. There were knees and backs. There was an arm around the young man's neck. In my opinion, it was extremely brutal. In an attempt to get to this young man, I was so close to the action that I was pushed aside by a cop trying to get in to subdue this gentleman. And he pushed me and nearly kicked a baby who was in a stroller. The melee and fracas was so crazy that I had to pull back two strollers that had children in them just for precaution for these kids. From there, there was a tight group of police that were around this young man, and then a second perimeter of police was created about 30 to 40 feet from the nucleus of this police action. From there, the police then let everyone know who was inside of the line of the police that were on the outer perimeter and on the inside of the perimeter that if you did not leave, you were going to be arrested. There was no dispersal order given at that point. The police then gave a dispersal order while they were advancing on 15 young people who sat in the middle of the group. They arrested all 15 of those people. While they were arresting those people, a larger crowd of third-party bystanders who did not come with the demonstration started surrounding the inner circle of cops. And at that time, there was more people, third-party observers, than there were cops or protesters, with people screaming things like, let him go. If you have to arrest them, you're going to have to arrest the whole park. This is 4th of July. This is freedom of speech, things like that.
So you contest the facts of the police report as
they... I completely contest the facts of the police report. I was less than 3 feet from the incident. There was no choking of the cop. The cop claims that there were blows on his back. There was no one close enough to place blows on the cops back. The only provoking on the part of the demonstrator was a move of his hands, which has a clear state in which he did make contact with the police officer, that everyone knows who's any sort of veteran of any type of protest or demonstration, that's going to be the end. The police is going to then take you down to the ground, which is what happened.
So are you friends with Zach, or were you just protesting with him? You have no relationship with him?
So that was Will Elder talking about the 4th of July, what's called the riot on most media coverage. It sounds slightly less than my understanding of a riot, but on July 4th, 2007, in which 15 young people were arrested without being charged during the arrest, just for assembling in the park peacefully. And apparently, since this man brushed away the cop's hand who was right next to his face, that's inciting a riot, I suppose. So this kind of fits with what we've seen a lot, especially in the last couple of years with the Occupy movement, where with the criminalization of protest and the violent reaction to peaceful protest that we've seen by police forces all over, and the increased militarization of police forces, especially larger ones. If you saw the riot gear of the NYPD, it was pretty unreal to see that in contrast with the Occupy protesters, who were just wearing, you know, normal clothes and were unarmed and in camps. So this really is where the focus seems to be going in a lot of law enforcement, is both on preemptive intelligence around peace, activism, organizing, anti-government organizing, etc. So we see this all over. This is a concrete example in Spokane. And in the vein of that, of focusing on intelligence gathering and this sort of McCarthy-esque focus on anti-American activities, whatever that means, even though, as the third-party bystanders in that video pointed out, they were exercising a very American right to assemble and use their freedom of speech. So that's all happening. The Department of Homeland Security has developed a much more robust domestic policy and like domestic campaigns targeted towards citizens themselves, which we're going to listen to a little bit. And there's more and more cooperation between local law enforcement and larger entities. So both state patrols, sheriff's departments collaborating with local departments, and then up to collaborating with Homeland Security and other national organizations. And we've seen that in Spokane. The Inlander has been doing really good coverage of what's going on with the Department of Homeland Security in Spokane. Folks may have noticed there's 4 or 5 large SUVs pretty much living at the federal building. And that seems strange because their border patrol in Spokane is quite far from the border. But as the Inlander discovered, and those who ask the Homeland Security officials there, the Border Patrol's jurisdiction is actually up to 100 miles off of the border, which we fall into that category. So if you haven't been following that story, it's very interesting. It's all on the archive on Inlander.com. But basically, the Department of Homeland Security had begun showing up on local police calls uninvited. So they have a police scanner and would just show up to domestic disturbance calls, I believe is what they said, and possibly like a burglary call, showing up uninvited. The local police force doesn't like it because it kind of mucks up what they're doing. They're trying to do an investigation their way, and a large federal agency suddenly becoming involved without invitation makes it more difficult for them to do their jobs. And it also, if you think about the context of the Department of Homeland Security, especially in regard to immigrant populations, that's going to lower the trust in the local police department even further among those groups. When they see Homeland Security rolling up with the police, their willingness to call the police is going to drop significantly, if it's not already a low willingness to do that. So that's something we're seeing a lot. And my friend and research partner, Van Nielsen, sent me some really interesting information on a great website called publicintelligence.net, which is basically just a collection of declassified and leaked government documents. And it's sorted by country in the world, and it's also sorted by department in the U.S. Government. So it's a pretty awesome site. And there's something brewing right now that's being launched called the Washington State Fusion Center. And we were wondering, what is a fusion center? It sounds very scientific. It sounds futuristic almost. But apparently the future is now. So the board of this fusion center is an unnamed at-large Eastern Washington law enforcement representative, the sheriff of King County, the chief of the Washington State Patrol, the chief of the Seattle Police Department, a member of the FBI Seattle Field Office, the president of the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, a United States attorney, and Washington State Homeland Security Advisor. So this is a list of big names on this board, and it's all basically internal folks who are high up in their own law enforcement agencies, making sort of a super agency, this fusion center. And the mission is to support the public safety and homeland security missions of federal, state, local, tribal agencies, and private sector entities by serving as the state's single fusion center, detecting, deterring, and preventing terrorist attacks, detecting, deterring, and preventing significant criminal activity, performing threat assessment and information management services, including supporting the protection of critical infrastructure and key resources, and providing support to all hazards preparation, planning, response, and recovery efforts. So basically, it sounds benign enough in theory that all of these agencies want to work together to better prevent terrorism and other threats, significant criminal threats. But if you think about it a little more, a lot of what this means, especially the focus on detecting and deterring, a lot of it has to do with information sharing and building larger intelligence gathering systems for domestic use. So basically, the most powerful law enforcement structures in the state are now working together, at least in King County. So this is mostly just going on in King County right now. It's the Seattle Police Department, the King County Sheriff's Department. To my knowledge, this isn't happening in Spokane County yet, but this is a model that's being used in almost every state. I found it for at least 30 or 40 states. And basically, the uneasiness for me is that even within the board, there's a huge lack of oversight for a group like this. They have a massive amount of resources at their disposal. If you combine the budgets of all of the groups that are involved in this fusion center, it's huge. It's a solid, probably third of King County's budget. If you look at general defense and law enforcement spending as an expenditure for cities, states, and nations, Homeland Security is a huge budget for the U.S. and all of that combined, with really the purpose of detecting suspicious activity among their own citizens, it becomes a pretty Orwellian police state-ish arrangement, if I would say so. So the only thing about it that is the reason why I think the person who I mentioned earlier was so against calling the U.S. a police state is because when we think of a police state, we think of predominantly, you know, Nazi Germany or fascist Italy or something like that, where there's uniforms and there's marching in the street and there's, you know, secret police. And a lot of the policies are in place in the U.S. for that, but it's a much quieter thing. Nobody knows that this is going on for the most part, you know, that all of these agencies are working together so overtly. And if they do know, they either buy into the official message, which is it's for your safety and we're stopping terrorism, even though terrorism means whatever we want it to mean, basically, under the Patriot Act and now the NDAA. So it's just, it's a little uneasy, and it's a lot of power in the hands of very few people. And that's where I think the trouble begins with any group. You know, when power and secrecy are given to a large group of people and denied to those that they are policing. Another interesting thing here on the Fusion Center overview is the definition of suspicious activity. So suspicious activity is observed behavior that may be indicative of intelligence gathering or pre-operational planning related to terrorism or other criminal activity. So examples that are given are taking photos of buildings with a cell phone, you know, having hushed conversations in public, observing routes of transit and things like that. Things that everyday citizens do very frequently is now legally defined as suspicious activity under arrangements like this. So while, you know, a lot of people like to say that that's just paranoia and people are conspiracy theorists who believe things like this, it's true. I mean, it's printed in the documents that our government's using. So just to check in, you are listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio, talking about whether or not there is a police state in the U.S., the state of policing locally, state, nationally, and otherwise, and what people can do if they want to become involved in issues like this or just learn more about it. One of the resources that you can use to learn more about it, this publicintelligence.net is a really great kind of library of resources that are almost all, just from what I've seen, their primary source government documents. So you can get it straight from the horse's mouth, as it were. And yeah. So this Washington State Fusion Center concept, like I said, is mostly in King County, and Spokane appears to not be in this loop. I'm sure that's probably part of the plan to roll this out in a broader way statewide, since we're the second largest urban area. We'd be kind of the next logical step. And I think this is different than the conversation that's happening between the city and the county about the county sheriff's department managing the Spokane Police Department. There's been talk of that, of a merger there. And that doesn't appear to me to be similar to this. I think that's more about financial savings and larger accountability. So, and the fact that Homeland Security isn't communicating with our local police force indicates that they're not working together in a concentrated way like this is happening in Seattle. So the other thing that I forgot to mention that's pretty important, I was hoping to interview a city council person this morning about this, but couldn't get a hold of anyone in time. The Department of Homeland Security also, without asking anyone, apparently, has installed cameras in the seventh floor offices at City Hall. And there's a small little blurb in the Inlander about a month ago about it. And Council President Ben Stuckert was, you know, interviewed and really perplexed about where these cameras came from. Not so much minding that they're there, but minding that they appeared overnight with no information. So it's a very bizarre back and forth that's going on. And it kind of points out the flaws in the bureaucracy of all these agencies, that they can't communicate with each other well enough to streamline what they're doing, even though the mission is to streamline what they're doing. So the other issue with these fusion centers and just general collaboration between local and federal law enforcement is the militarization of police forces. That's already happening in cities around the U.S., including here, and it's likely to continue. The caliber of weapons that local police forces have access to has greatly increased in the last, I'd say, 10 to 15 years. As we de-escalate conflicts globally, we still have all of those resources to use. The military-industrial complex is still a huge part of our economy, and we need to do something with those weapons. So we end up with cities having tanks, you know, and having combat vehicles and, you know, automatic weapons and all kinds of things that you really wouldn't think would be necessary for normal everyday local policing, which is what people talk about when people talk about cutting police budgets at the city level. People don't talk about preventing terrorism, and they don't talk about issues like that. They talk about property crime. That's what people are talking about in Spokane right now. You don't need an AR-15 to deter property crime. You know, it's kind of an old-fashioned policing that you need for crimes like that. And those are crimes that people care about in their cities. And those are the reasons that people want police, is to, you know, keep murderers off the streets, keep their homes and their possessions safe. But all of the literature of most of these law enforcement groups is more about protecting the economic interests of the nation at large and preventing terrorism. Those are both pretty vague, and that's what concerns me about it. So, and Spokane is, you know, a military center in many ways. We have Fairchild Air Force Base, which everyone likes to say, you know, is a big job creator in our region, but I personally believe that there's better jobs that people can have that don't involve killing others and developing the means to do so. And we also, we're the location, the only national location of the SERE school, the Seek, Evade, I don't remember what the acronym is for, but I will look it up. But basically, it's the school that's used to teach escape tactics and also interrogation resistance. It's a resistance school, basically, where special forces will go to learn how to evade all kinds of tactics. They've also been, however, accused of teaching enhanced interrogation techniques such as waterboarding used at Guantanamo Bay and basically developing those methods in order to develop resistance methods to them, but then using the methods themselves internationally in conflict. I'm hoping that I'm explaining that properly. So that's been developed there right here in our backyard, you know, 20 miles south of town. It's something to keep in mind for those who are either anti-war activists or just interested in where their tax money goes in general. That's a good chunk of what Spokane pays for and what we support. And I don't know of a single candidate, at least gubernatorially or in Congress, who is against the Air Force Base being there and against it being a large part of our economy, because it's such a, I mean, it's political suicide to say that in many ways, even though there are a lot of people who are anti-war and anti-military around. Yeah, so no matter who you vote for, they're probably going to support that. And Fairchild also stored a large amount, a huge arsenal of nuclear weapons and warheads until the mid-90s. So it's always been a key player, and I don't think it's likely to go anywhere, despite the kind of calls every election season or so that Fairchild might be on the chopping block and you need to vote for X candidate to make sure those jobs are secured. Most of that isn't really going anywhere. Of the top 10 budgets in the U.S. government for 2013, I was just looking at the 2013 budget, also available online. Many things are. It's easy to educate yourself. That's the good news. The military comes out cleanly on top. Defense spending, just the Department of Defense, is set at $672.9 billion, if you can wrap your head around that number. But when you combine that with the State Department budget, the Homeland Security budget, and the Veterans Affairs budget, which are all in the top 10 highest funded budgets, departments, the total of those four comes to $927.5 billion for 1 year. So that's a dizzying amount. It dwarfs the amount spent on healthcare, on education. Those are our other biggest ticket items, our Department of Health and Human Services and Department of Education. But defense, especially when you combine it with Homeland Security and Veterans Affairs, it just leaves everything else in the dust. So none of those jobs appear to be in trouble. That seems to be what's meant by job creation to a lot of people. So I guess the main concern that I and many people have with the Department of Homeland Security is both that it enforces these policies that don't work, especially if you want to look at the Mexican border and their focus on cartel leaders. Their own studies say that taking out individual leaders in a cartel does nothing, contributes absolutely net zero to drug trafficking. That if you just take out the kingpins, you know, that doesn't work. It's still going to happen. And so that's part of their flawed concept. And the other is that the part that I guess I just am uncomfortable with is their focus on snitching, I suppose, and their focus on kind of the citizen Homeland Security agent, you know, the citizen who's always aware, and their whole see something, say something campaign is pretty reminiscent of a lot of propaganda from other countries that we may remember from different totalitarian states. It's really interesting how that works. And it's hard because at some point, yes, if you see something out of the ordinary or criminal happening, you should say something. But this, with their focus on their skewed definition of suspicious activity and just the ambiguous definition of terrorism, it turns the table in a way that I'm not personally comfortable with. And it's really just kind of creepy. It's really Orwellian and bizarre. I first came into contact with the see something, say something concept when I was in the Seattle Amtrak station, and they play this video on loop constantly that is all about, at Amtrak, we care about fighting terrorism. Probably true. You know, it's a great, I want to be safe when I take the train. But they have this video that's all about, watch everyone in the lobby because people in the lobby might be terrorists. And it just, it's playing in the background. It's playing on screens, you know, spread throughout the lobby. And it really just puts this uncomfortable feeling in the air, in the whole station. And it does make people paranoid. I mean, it made me feel paranoid. I was wondering, you know, is plugging my cell phone in over there and walking away suspicious activity? Am I going to be reported and searched for talking on my phone too quietly or too loudly, or taking pictures, which I always do when I travel? So it really contributes, I think, to paranoia and just to distrust of others, which is the opposite of what a society needs in order to be successful. If you can't trust other people who are in your same world, we're all on the same world, but if you can't trust each other, then you don't really have anything. So this is an example of one of those videos, so you don't have to hear my poor imitation. This is a video produced by the Department of Homeland Security for the retail sector. I think it's meant to be shown to mall employees and things like that. The scene he's describing at the beginning is, in fact, a shopping mall. I think it's King Street in Seattle, but I don't know for sure. So I'm just going to play part of the audio from this video. It's quite long, so I'm just going to play the beginning to give you a feel for what the Department of Homeland Security is going for in their advertising lately. Says the Department of Homeland Security presents What's in Store? Ordinary people, extraordinary events.
Every day, millions of Americans come to places like this. Happy, safe, and secure. They are buying and selling, keeping our economy's wheels moving. And you can help keep it that way. We all share the responsibility to fight terror and criminal misconduct. But as someone who works in a store, mall, shopping center, or market, you have an obligation to help. Because sometimes ordinary people can stop extraordinary events. What can you do? You can recognize and report suspicious behavior in your workplace. This is not hard. You know what's normal, usual, and expected, and what's not. Terrorists and criminals may look no different than the shoppers around you at all times. But don't think that you can spot suspicious people. Things aren't always as they seem.
So that's a small taste of the Department of Homeland Security's retail sector see something, say something video. The tone of that, you know, it's very the spy music in the background and all of it is really interesting. But what I find really kind of disturbing about the language is that the word obligation, that they say not only are you a retail worker, your job is no longer just to, you know, press buttons on the cash register, stock merchandise, etc. It's also to be on the lookout for these suspicious people who are everywhere inside the mall. And cultivating that kind of atmosphere is just, I think it couldn't be anything but destructive, because especially when you have an economic system like we do, and people who are working retail are generally fairly disempowered by the system at large, because it's generally minimum wage. You're not really receiving any benefits. You're kind of just, as the video says, with a lack of irony, you're keeping the gears turning. And for then another part of your job to be spying on other people, then that's a taste of power that you've been denied. And this whole corruption coming from power concept is how we get police brutality, in my opinion, and how we get mismanaged international policing efforts and things like that. So the whole thing just kind of makes my stomach turn personally, but that's what's going on right now. So see something, say something is the big campaign. I guess you have to decide for yourself what is necessary to report and to whom, and maybe it's just your own conscience and letting people know when you see something you don't like or think is suspicious, or letting someone else know, or calling the police, or calling straight up to Homeland Security. I'm not sure what the plan should be, but that's what's going on. And I guess part of where I want to go with this is the whole going back to what is a police state. It has a lot to do with mobilizing citizens to inform on one another. And I thought a really good summary of that also that my friend Van sent to me is Naomi Wolf, who wrote The End of America and some other essays and books. I don't always like her, but I think this list is really succinct. It's her 10 steps to closing down an open society. So step one invoke a terrifying internal and external enemy. In our case, we have kind of radical Islamic terrorism, international terrorism, and then domestic terrorism, which is always described in a very vague way. So we've got that. Step two is create a gulag. We have the examples of Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib, FEMA camps. There's all kinds of examples of this. Even domestically, many people will say, well, you know, Guantanamo, even though it's bad, it wasn't on U.S. soil, so it doesn't count. But if you look at after Katrina, after Hurricane Katrina, there was basically a prison erected and multiple people who stayed, first responders, you know, who stayed in Louisiana when the hurricane happened, were saving people, taking them out of their houses. Some of them were arrested on pretty vague terrorism charges or never charged and kept in a makeshift prison for upwards of a month with no charge, no contact with their families or anything. Families believe they were dead. I can post some information about that. So that's already happened on U.S. soil also. Step three in Naomi Wolf's 10 steps to closing down an open society is develop a thug caste. So this would be, you know, German brown shirts, Italian black shirts, the militarization of local law enforcement that we've already discussed. Propaganda. I'm not sure why that's written there. That's in my notes. And then you also see mercenary armies that aren't enforced upon like normal armies would be, such as Blackwater, who's changed their name multiple times, but we all know them as Blackwater still. So private armies, private prisons, I would include in that as well. Number four is set up an internal surveillance system, such as the video we just heard from Department of Homeland Security, which increases paranoia and ironically increases people's suspicious behavior. If they feel that they're being watched, they'll probably act a little more shifty than they would normally. You also see internal surveillance through social networking. Facebook was partially funded by intelligence agencies at its startup. They've wanted to build a database like that for a long time. There's a lot of quotes. There's a wealth of information about that on the internet. And you also see it in the adaptation of drones from their lethal, you know, their armed drones to surveillance drones and unleashing those domestically. There's a lot of talk about that right now. I was also looking at best inventions of either 2011 or 2012, and one was the insect drone, which is a mosquito-sized computerized drone that can take video, high-definition video, audio, and can also take DNA samples in the same way that a mosquito would. So that's something that's heavily invested in as well. A little disturbing. Number five on Naomi Wolf's list is harass citizens groups, which we all know has happened from, you know, G20 protests, WTO in Seattle, even, you know, within Occupy, peace protesters being arrested before protests. These things have happened for years and years and continue to happen. Denying permits, using kettling, using mace on protesters, even when they are not acting out and hurting others. Also, the internal subversion of grassroots organizations is another tactic that's been used widely in other countries as well as domestically. So that's well on its way as well. Engage in number six is engage in arbitrary detention and release. That's something that was just declared unconstitutional by a judge as part of the National Defense Authorization Act, which Obama signed into law. The part that called for indefinite detention of American citizens internationally without charge was stricken down as unconstitutional, which I wouldn't think that would even have to go to court, because anyone with a basic knowledge of the Constitution knows that that is in violation of it. And I mean, the Patriot Act had had a lot of provisions that had to do with arbitrary detention, civil liberties being stripped in general, and all of that. Number seven on Naomi Wolf's list of 10 ways to close down an open society is to target key individuals. We're seeing that right now pretty dramatically. I think probably the most common, the most well-known example would be Julian Assange with WikiLeaks. Also a great resource if you're looking for information on issues like this. He's been chased around the world basically, now in Ecuador seeking political asylum. They haven't decided if they're going to grant it to him yet, but basically saying you exposing information about us is terrorism, and we are going to take you down and your entire organization in partnership with the economic sector. That's where they come in. You know, PayPal and Amazon blocking donations to WikiLeaks, and basically all the major credit card companies striking against a group. That's new in my knowledge. I don't think that that's happened before. There's other, there's six other whistleblowers that have been indicted on the Espionage Act from the early part of last century under the Obama administration, usually for mishandling classified information. So you get John Curacao in 2007, leaking information about waterboarding, Tom Drake, leaking information about the Thin Thread data collection program, and he was dumped for a massive waste known as Trailblazer, Civil Liberties and Privacy. Sorry, I'm reading someone else's notes. Shammai Leibovitz leaked documents to reporters concerned about Israeli attacks on Iran. Stephen Jinwoo Kim was a State Department contractor who leaked North Korea nuclear info to Fox News. Bradley Manning was, we probably know Bradley Manning as well. He's been held in detention for almost 800 days, I believe, much of it in solitary confinement. He was an intelligence analyst who leaked video of the U.S. helicopter mowing down journalists to WikiLeaks. And then we have Jeffrey Sterling, CIA, who leaked unauthorized national defense docs planning to take out Iran's nuclear program. And there's also, there's other key individuals who were not whistleblowers and who were not targeted in the same overt way. But there's a lot of cases of people losing their jobs. Dan Rather losing his job over his Bush military record, his reporting on that. There's many, many examples of reporters, individuals within the groups they work with being fired or killed in some cases due to their dissent. So step eight on Naomi's list is control the press. Obviously, we're here on community radio, so people probably know something about corporate media and how it works and the services it does not do to people. If you don't know this already, six companies control all media, nearly all media in the U.S. They are Time Warner, News Corp, CBS, Viacom, Disney, and Comcast. So we have all of those. And we also have Romney's Bain Capital controlling Clear Channel, which is the bulk of talk radio. I'm not sure the percentage, but we here at KYRS are in the minority of community media. And if you control the press, you control most of thought, unfortunately. So that's step eight on Naomi Wolf's list of 10 ways to close down an open society. Number nine is dissent equals treason. That's kind of what we've been covering for a while here. Persecuting whistleblowers, the whole idea of that's really internalized by a lot of people of love it or leave it. You know, if you don't like America, then you can get out. Kind of missing the point of dissent being a fundamental aspect of patriotism. And also my friend pointed out the university atmosphere also really, really discourages dissent these days. You really think of the university as being a hotbed of activism and action. And a lot of that's really settled down in the last, you know, 20 years or so, with some exceptions. And I think a lot of it's being institutionalized that you don't really question too much and your professors know best and their bosses at the Department of Education know best. So, and then the 10th and final is suspend the rule of law. So basically, the Constitution doesn't count anymore with things like the NDAA, basically trampling on people's civil liberties and just saying this is the law now. Other examples would be, you know, Bush declaring war without approval from Congress, Obama skipping right over Congress altogether and going to the UN for approval in Libya, etc. Those are all examples. So I guess in the last 5 minutes or so, I got carried away there. But do we have a police state? That depends on how you want to define it. Are there serious problems with our policing policies, both locally, nationally, and internationally? Most certainly, given the kind of incidents we've been talking about today. All kinds of other things there's no time to talk about. Are there probably good individual police officers? Yes, who want to do the right thing. Can they do it within the structure they're in? I'm not sure. But some solutions, I mean, basic ones, if you want to get into voting, one way, if people care about a police state, then they can't support leaders who continue the policies that we have now. And that includes Republicans and Democrats. That's one thing that they all seem to agree on, is that we're on the right course with defense and such, and that we should just stay the course, or maybe decrease it slightly. But there's none that I know of that significantly oppose much of it. So do your research there when it comes to voting. And also just educating yourself and others. I mentioned publicintelligence.net as a good resource during this show. Also wikileaks.org. And don't underestimate the power of just using your direct observation. Just look around you. Think about, you know, why are those Homeland Security SUVs in my neighborhood? What is going on? And drawing your own conclusions. That's really key. Not listening to other people's analysis. Not even mine. But your own, and doing your own research. And yeah, we have some local solutions also from Terry Sawyer. I think I have time to play, talking from that same AutoZem event about what she learned from the whole experience. There's also, in case I don't have time at the end, there's local groups, SPARC, the Spokane Police Accountability and Reform Coalition. They have local meetings. You can find information about them on the Peace and Justice Action League website, pgiles.org. And here is Terry Sawyer talking about what the solutions that she learned were from working on this case.
I did extensive research into three areas of law, that are three issues dealing with police accountability, that I said, if they'll just do these three things, I think we will have a different experience in Spokane. One was to create an Office of Police Accountability. The second was to create and train, based on a national model, the crisis intervention team, which is a subset within the police department that is specially trained to deal with people who are disabled and or have some sort of dysregulating drug in their system that causes them to act out in a way that is very bizarre. And these people are specially trained to de-escalate those situations. It's been successful in Ohio and Florida and Tennessee. And so a really well-trained officers that are hand-selected, that have the personality to do this, could go a long way in achieving reduction in fear within the disabled population and their families, and as well as obviously reducing the risk of significant harm and or death in cases. And the third thing was a complete revamping of the current use of force model being used by the Spokane Police Department. Before the settlement, obviously, Mr. Burns is with us today. He's our police accountability, but we had significant struggle in giving that office the teeth that it needs to do the work of police accountability. And I'm confident that that's coming, because I just am. I won't accept anything else. That Mr. Burns, or whoever serves in his capacity, absolutely has to have the power to do a parallel investigation at scenes where there is significant injury or death, alongside with the detectives who are there to do the investigation. He's there to ensure that the policies and procedures for a objective investigation occur, i.e. the officers that were involved in the incident do not have the opportunity to talk to each other on their way to the police station. They're not housed in the police station together, and they certainly don't get days to prepare for their deposition or statements. Those are all things that are not part of the best practices. And if that...
That was Terry Sawyer from June 14th's Walking with AutoZem event. Thank you again to Don Hamilton for recording that and sharing it, and for Local News for broadcasting it on the 25th. You can find the complete audio from that on the podcast page of Local News. It was June 25th. Just in closing, SPARC is the local group dedicated to police accountability and reform. Their goals are as follows, quote from their website: establishing effective, independent civilian oversight mechanisms that allow for timely and credible independent investigations of alleged police abuse and misconduct, such as the Ombudsman's Office having investigative authority, ensuring that civilian oversight mechanisms also have the power and resources to review law enforcement practices, issue public reports, and make recommendations for changes in such practices and policies, serving as an effective watchdog on local government and civilian oversight bodies to ensure adequate attention, resources, and performance with regard to holding law enforcement agencies accountable, changing attitudes and practices that foster a community culture of tolerance and denial when it comes to police misconduct, changing policies and practices that serve to harass and intimidate victims and witnesses of police misconduct, promoting effective community policing with strict adherence to state-of-the-art use of force protocols. That's happening now with the Use of Force Commission with the city. Securing meaningful commitments from area law enforcement agencies to eliminate racially biased policing, and changing police practices that contribute to the criminalization of poverty. Another action going on, other than if you being involved with SPARK, is something that folks can do if they're interested in police accountability. The city of Spokane, part of Mayor Condon's police reform plan, is his plan is oversight, community involvement, training, and enhanced delivery of service. And the Use of Force Commission is getting going right now, and you can follow all of their work on the city website, SpokaneCity.org. Thank you for listening. This has been Praxis, and we've been talking about the police state, local policing, international policing, and everything that goes with it. Thanks for listening, and I will be back next week, live Monday at 10 a.m.